the seasons as defined by the sun and the earth and the stars, the heavens, are the ones that somehow or another seems easiest to kind of relate to or become attuned to. And so next Sunday is the winter solstice, but I won't be with the group then. And so what I wanted to do this evening is some of the things that we have done as a sangha when we've been able to meet together in person. And that includes some of, you know, maybe a little music, certainly includes some of the materials left over from a long time ago when our sangha met at the Unitarian Church. And one of the associate pastors there, Joan Van Beesler, who in addition to being an ordained Unitarian minister, was also the convener of the Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans, which met for a lot of years, you know, at the church. And for several years' time, five, 6 years, I guess it was, Joan and I would do this sort of joint service, this kind of a multi-faith convergence service around the solstice called the Celebration of Light. And we would draw in texts and rituals from various of the wisdom traditions that all placed particular significance on the solstice and on both the drawing in and the sense of hibernation and gestation, and also the rebirth and the coming forth, and that sort of thing. So what I want to do this evening is for us to practice together, to sit, just like we always do. And then I wanted to bring in a few elements of that, that service from those years gone by, certainly including touching on some of the Buddhist teachings around light and the light within and bringing it forth. And then maybe go out with a couple of the songs that we used to do when we would have our annual Thanksgiving Day of Gratitude and potluck and our circumambulation of City Park Lake on the solstice eve. And so anyway, just that. So I want to try to make sure we try to stay in touch with those traditions and also look forward to perhaps the solstice of, Thanksgiving and the solstice of 2021 when we can do these practices together in person once more. Okay, so to start with, let's settle in and we'll do our practice together. And as we begin the practice, I'm going to do some phrases from a kind of a dedicatory practice. And it draws a little bit from the Mahayana tradition of the Bodhisattva vow of devoting one's practice efforts and one's wisdom to the liberation of all beings. Borrows just a little bit from the Francis of Assisi's self-dedicatory prayer, but mostly focuses on turning the practice of the Brahma Viharas from an inward exercise in cultivating those qualities in one's own mind to sharing the fruits of those qualities with a wider world. And so once we settle in and begin to practice, then I'll recite some of those phrases that you can reflect on and repeat as your own practice to the extent you wish. And then after we've sat together, then just reflect on some of those thoughts, the Buddha's teachings in particular on cultivating these beneficial and transformative practices within, and then bringing them forth, coming into the world, letting our light shine. And he used that imagery a lot, especially toward the end of his life, be a lamp, okay, so here we go. Let's settle in, and see what we might be able to do by way of getting in touch with the moment and getting in touch with being in this body and being together here at this moment in time, even though it's only through the medium of the screens in front of us, or the phone at our ear. But nonetheless, here we are together. So taking just a moment to settle in, whether we're sitting on a chair or a cushion or a bench, floor, just relaxing a little and surrendering to a relationship between the center of gravity in our body and the center of gravity of the earth, fourth Heisen mile is directly below you. Just relaxing. Seeing that we're centered and at ease, arms relaxed at our sides, and our hands may be folded on our laps, resting on our legs. Allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Whether we notice the breathing mostly as the air moving in and out of the nostrils, or maybe it's the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the surface of the ocean on a calm day, or the gentle ripples in a mountain lake, and there's just a slight breeze flowing across the surface. Rising and falling. Drawing in nutrient, letting go of that which is no longer needed. Nourishing with the in-breath and cleansing with the out-breath. Breathing in the present moment and breathing out needless thoughts and worries. Breathing in the moment, letting go of the past. Where there is hatred, may I bear witness and offer compassion. Where there is sadness, may I bear witness and offer joy. Where there is anxiety and fear, may I bear witness and offer peace. where there is ill will and aversion, may I bear witness and offer love. Else anyone knows about or would like to share vis-a-vis the Sangha or other stuff coming up? I had an opportunity to sit in on a really fascinating dialogue between Bhante Anilayo and an author named Rhonda Magid. And she is a law professor at the University of San Francisco, a longtime meditator. And she just wrote this book, you know, the sort of the inner life of racial reckoning. I can't remember the title of it right now, but I bought it and I've started to read it already. It's like, okay, you know, some of us did a little book group recently on Isabel Wilkerson's Caste, and then we were seeking to look at it through a Dharmic perspective. But this book is by a someone who's been doing, you know, race relations workshops for 20 years, who is also an extraordinarily experienced meditator and teacher. Before we go our separate ways tonight, I'll get you the appropriate citation, but I found it to be really a moving experience just to sit in on their dialogue. And they're going to be co-leading a retreat together out of kind of a retreat slash workshop out of the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. I believe it's going to be sometime this spring. And so if you just go to their website, it'll crop up. But I'll, like I say, before we go our separate ways this evening, I'll be sure to pull up that citation and share it with everyone who might be interested. So are there other things that we would benefit from knowing about that anyone would like to share tonight? Okay. Well, like I was saying earlier, this is it's sort of a poignant evening for me in some ways, because over the years, our Sangha, the Insight Meditation Community of Denver, we've kind of established these routines and rituals and things we like to do together, you know, and the Thanksgiving Day of Mindfulness and the potluck and sharing a little bit of music, and then our solstitial circumambulation of City Park Lake and honoring the directions and the, you know, and their relationship to the Brahma Viharas. It's kind of an interweaving of it's kind of multiple traditions into an experience that results in us feeling perhaps a little more grounded in the earth and the rhythms of nature and its relationship to Buddha Dharma. And I've been wondering about, you know, doing that or not. And my family next week at the moment of solstice wanted to do a family gathering, and I kind of worried a little bit, I guess, about seeking to sponsor an event for us as a Sangha there when there are the, you know, the various things going on that would tend to mitigate against it. But I guess I want to leave it up to the Sangha in terms of whether some would like to gather at the lake next Sunday and do that. I don't think I'm going to be there, but it's become a pretty meaningful, you know, event for us over the years, and certainly I'm expecting that a year from now we'll definitely be doing it again. So at the end of our time this evening together, I guess if there are those who would like to reflect a little bit on whether that would be, you know, something that would be worthwhile doing, then I think we should for sure do that. So what I've been thinking about in terms of the rhythm of the seasons and where we find ourselves now, and certainly with the kind of the so the massive amplification of so much that's going on in our lives right now as a society in terms of this really precipitous election that we just went through, in terms of the manifestations, the examples, the illustrations of radical social and economic inequity that we've been witnessing over the course of this last year, of the worst public health disaster in a century here in the United States, and what may turn out to be the worst public health disaster in the history of our nation, unfolding for us just sort of day by day. And what that has compelled us to do, required us to do, if, you know, if we're trying to take seriously our care for ourselves and our care for each other, is a, gathering in and a drawing back and a going within, even as we look for means, just like we're doing tonight, you know, and that information technology is making possible, to still stay in touch and still stay connected. But physically, right now, it is in an even more pervasive way than the seasons in the northern latitudes indicate anyway. It's just this time of pulling in, of going in, of insulating oneself physically to some extent. You know, warm-blooded animals in the northern hemisphere, especially the further north you go, you know, for millions of years, natural selection has created species whose very survival depends on this ability. When it starts to get really cold and life-threatening to some extent, to go within, to find a safe and a warm place, and to reside there during this season, and then to come forth again the spring. In the Buddhist time and in the Buddhist place, and you know, it's true in certainly in South Asia, where he was born and raised, where he grew up, certainly in Southeast Asia, where the Theravada tradition took root and developed and whatnot. There are distinct seasons. They're not like the ones that we experience here in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, cold winters and that kind of going in. But each of the geographic regions in Southeast, South Asia, has what in the Buddhist time and still today in India and in Southeast Asia, it's called the rain season. And like, I was, my wife and I did kind of a pilgrimage to Thailand, since that's my most direct, you know, kind of teaching lineage in the Theravada tradition. A few years ago, we went to Thailand and we were there in January and February. And that was supposed to be when it was like relatively dry and, you know, the climate was very, I I'm glad I wasn't there in the depths of the rains season, because and when I was the year that I lived in Vietnam and serving with the military in 1966-67, when people asked, you know, like what it was like in terms of the climate and all, I said, well, you know, basically it only rained once. You know, it started in October and it ended in April. And then, you know, the same's true in India where the Buddha lived. You know, it's like, you know, and it's like rain, like we don't experience. It wasn't even separate drops. It was just like these sheets. It was like, you know, you're walking around a waterfall, you know. It's like my East Texas relatives from, you know, long ago, you know, they were ranchers and whatnot. That was like a cow peeing on a flat rock, you know. It's like there's just, there's water everywhere, you know. And so, and this was true in the time of the Buddha. And so there is about a 3-month period where, you know, where you just don't go out. You know, if there's no need to go out, you just don't go out, you know, and you do what you may have been able to do, gather fuel and food and whatnot, and you have some kind of shelter to go into. And so it's this period of gathering in, drawing in, of looking inward, adjusting. And so once the, you know, when the Buddha first began to teach, he had no idea whether what he was trying to teach was going to get across, was going to have any meaning or relevance for anybody. And it turned out that it kind of did. And then, you know, his more and more followers, you know, became part of his sangha, his teaching, until finally, you know, there was a big sangha gathered around him, and there were other sanghas that he also led that were in the same regions. But during the rainy season, that is, you know, when it was rainier than other times of the year, everybody would gather in. And for about a 3-month period, after his sanghas were well established and whatnot, there would be what was called the rains retreat, or the season when people engaged in prolonged, extended periods of meditation. You know, whether it was sitting meditation or walking, lying down, where the mindfulness would just get really powerful and be really continuous. And he would give Dharma talks wherever he was. And then after the rains retreat was over, was the period of going forth. And once his following had become very robust, and he had a lot of senior students and others who really kind of had the hang of it and understood the teachings and knew how to convey them, then that was the period where it was coming out. It was going forth. It was a period of sharing. And not only were the monks and nuns who were part of the monastic sangha sharing what they had learned previously, but what they were also sharing was the immediacy of the fruition of their practice during the time of the rains retreat. And so for the 45 years that the Buddha taught, this became sort of the routine, the rhythm for how the Dharma grew and flourished in northeastern India and then began to spread elsewhere around the world. And the reason that I share this little bit of history is because it's not all that different from, and in fact, at the meditation centers here in the United States, certainly, that rhythm has been followed, that traditional rhythm has been followed since the very time that the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts was founded in 1976, and Spirit Rock Meditation Center in 2000. There are different kinds of retreats and workshops held over the course of the year, but in Insight Meditation Society in Barre, starting in September of every year through the end of the calendar year, there is basically the equivalent of the Rains retreat. It's a 3-month retreat that's offered there. And at Spirit Rock, there's a 2-month retreat that's offered from January through the end of February. And the idea is somewhat the same. It's for people that want to experience what the Buddha Dharma Sangha in the time of the Buddha did, gathering in and just really drenching oneself in sort of continuous practice with frequent teachings and interviews. But I mean, that's the tradition, that's the roots of the tradition from which what we do here today grew. And so whether or not you find yourself able to go off and do one of these long retreats or not, what we are nonetheless going through now at this time of the year, at the time of the solstice, is we are experiencing, you know, as warm-blooded animals, the kind of the going in, kind of a sense of, I don't know, maybe inner hibernation. But at the same time, the balance, the other side of that coin is, and this is where, for me, I think the solstice is kind of an interesting point, because certainly with the Celtic traditions of Europe, this is the time when things begin to flip. You know, when the intensity of the focus on going in and reflecting inward and appreciating the value of the darkness, of coming to some accommodation with and some acceptance of that, of the unknown, of that which cannot be seen, begins to flip, and we start to come forth again. You know, in the Celtic, pre-Christian Celtic traditions, you know, we talk about the rebirth of the sun. It's the time when, you know, the moon has been ascendant for up until this period of time, and an acknowledgement and an honoring of that which is obscured, kind of surrendering to that which we don't know or don't see. And then it flips over, and it's the beginning of the coming forth of sharing that which has gestated up until that point going forward. And so that's why I wanted to share the vows that I was reading during the time that we were sitting. You know, it's like there's this period where we cultivate internally a sense of self-compassion, an ability to know and to summon, when it's possible, joy, even when there's sadness, and to know and to summon peace of mind when there's anxiety and disturbance and fear, and to know and to summon love where there's aversion and ill will. And not only to know them and to recognize them and to bring them forth, but to radiate them, to begin to share them with others. And so it's not like flipping a switch. It's not like, you know, first one, then the other, binary. It's more this kind of this range, this compendium of, you know, the going, coming inside, and then coming out again. So in the seminary program I went through at Spirit Rock a few years ago, 20 years ago, they put together these teaching vows for us to take going forward, and a lot of them were based on the teachings that the Buddha gave to his followers who are going out after the rain season, going out to share the Dharma. And the first of the five was, may I be present for suffering in the end of suffering. And so what that meant was being there for whatever's there, you know, may I be present for suffering and for the end of suffering. Did a retreat a few years ago with Sally Armstrong, a wonderful senior teacher at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Northern California. It was a retreat where she was teaching metta, loving kindness meditation. She said, "Well, one of the, you know, of the many ways to do metta that still needs help." She said, there can be this tendency, it's like you have this baseball bat with the word meta carved on it, and then you run around looking for situations that seem to need meta, and you start bashing away at the situation, you know, as if you're going to conquer it with your practice, you know, obliterate it, whatnot. And so it's like, no, not so much. So it's about first recognizing, this kind of bearing witness to suffering or to sadness or to ill will or to anxiety and fear, wherever you see it, and it's whether you see it in yourself or whether you see it in another, but just to honor its presence without wanting to go away, without trying to make it different, and then say, well, to this situation where I find where I find suffering, to this situation where I find sadness, to this situation where I find anxiety or fear or ill will, may I bring compassion and joy and equanimity and love. Yeah. And that's whether it's a situation that we find within ourselves or that we find in others. And so it's this second half of the coin, that kind of bringing it forth and sharing with others. And for me, this time of year, this time of the solstice is the time to both recognize the inner work that we may have been doing around the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas or insight or whatever else it is that's going on, and to honor it and to value it and to recognize that it's the kind of work that only can happen from going inside and hanging out and being with whatever we find there in kind of a respectful way and accepting way, that's the hibernation phase. That's the internal work that needs to happen before the external sharing can begin to occur, and that now we are beginning to enter a time, you know, as gradually we emerge from winter into spring, and as a vaccine begins to become available, and as we gradually find ourselves able to re-engage society, you know, the coming forth after the period of extraordinary hibernation that's been kind of forced upon us, that the coming forth that the spring and summer may offer, and both societally as well as spiritually, I think there's tremendous potential there. You know? So, at any rate, those are those are some of the views that have come to mind for me during, you know, this period of transition that we find ourselves in. And so I would definitely like to spend a certain amount of time now listening rather than talking. And so if there's anything at all that I've said that's touched upon, any thoughts that you might have that you might, or sentiments you might want to share, or questions that you might have, yeah, this is a good time to do it. So please, I see Jim's hand up. You need to, yeah, okay. Go for it, Jim.
Yeah, I was just thinking that I wish the popular culture could hear this, what you had to say about, this is a perfect time for us to quarantine ourselves. This is a perfect time for us to be socially distant. This is a perfect time for a little social hibernation because it's the solstice, because the days are getting shorter. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like there's this intersection between this health crisis and the time of the year. And yeah. I wish somehow the popular culture could put that out there, the media or people in leadership positions in our country. Just seems like it would just be such an easy thing for people to get their arms around.
Yeah, there is this enormous natural lesson kind of being offered to all of us. You know, this is really a time for us to gather in to protect ourselves and each other, and there will be an opportunity for coming forth, you know, when it's safe. Thank you. Please. Others who may want to share.
Hi, this is Sarah. Hi.
Sarah, please.
Sarah Wells. Hi. Yeah. Nice to see everybody. I just wanted to share that I had to go out today to help buy a coat for my daughter. And but that's all we did. And I was so grateful for the pandemic because I didn't feel like I had to race around trying to find presents for people that might give me a present or, you know, kind of have things ready at home for a little get together. I just felt this great relief. I've always wondered why I feel so stressed out in December. It's probably because I feel like I have to buy things. So thanks to this pandemic, yeah.
It's interesting, you know, how many of our kind of daily rhythms and routines and whatnot that we just sort of took for granted and figured, well, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is what we're supposed to do. How so much of that has just gotten, I don't know, put on hold or just said, or is kind of offered a reflection, an invitation to reflect on, really? Is this really important? Is this really how we need to be doing things? You know, are there other ways to do things instead? I kind of doubt that there is going to be the 9-to-5 go into the office thing, certainly for privileged white collar workers, in the future, anything like there was in the past. You know, or the sense that somehow or another you have to fly all the way across the country for a really important 2-hour meeting and then get on another plane and fly all the way back across the country again, that maybe we've kind of taught ourselves a different way to be together, and like some of the rituals that you were just talking about, maybe not so quite so important. Maybe not quite what maybe they don't have the gravitas that we thought they did before they were called into question. I think it's going to provide a real invitation to look at things, a lot of things, in a somewhat different way. Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. So, Andrea.
can unmute myself. So I don't know what just happened. You went away. Okay. Anyway, so it's Hanukkah now, and I've been doing this ritual which really honors going within time, which is I light the menorah and say the blessings, then I turn off all my lights and just sit as the candles burn down until they burn down. And when they burn down, each candle wisps up into the air in smoke that feels like honoring death. And it's a very powerful ritual for me, you know, in lieu of what would usually be happening at this time of year.
Yes. Very, very nice. You know, certainly going back, at least in European traditions, going back, you know, thousands of years, the whole symbolism and significance of light and the arising of light, the going out of light. The Buddha's when he was asked about to reflect on teachings on rebirth and whatnot, he used the image of a candle. He said it's like when one candle burns out and you use it to light another one. But the other aspect of it that you just touched upon that I think is equally important, you know, not the whole thing of sort of eternal light and there's always brightness and whatnot, but rather that just it's also just as important to focus on exactly what you said, which is to honor the finiteness of the existence of the flame and also of its extinguishment, you know, because the other thing that the Buddha taught is that, you know, he used the candle as a symbol for, you know, rebirth and whatnot. But the other thing that symbol of light is used for is when he taught about awakening, when he taught about freedom, when he talked about nirvana, it was that the consciousness, when it is infused with a sense of self or ego, is like a burning flame. And it has an appetite that always is looking for oxygen and fuel, and it wants to continue to replicate itself. But that coming up on the moment of awakening is the experiencing of the extinguishing of the flame with complete acceptance and surrender. It's like, just let it go. And then when you see the smoke, it's just, it's gone. And you relax into no thingness, you relax into absence. And that's another translation of the word nirvana. It's absence. Gone. Thank you. I love it. That's so sweet. I appreciate you sharing that, you know, because we're always talking about, you know, the focusing on the light and the eternal light and so on and so forth. But that was only half the equation as far as the Buddhist teaching is concerned. The other one was just what you said. And for me, it's also useful because I've been doing a lot of reading and a certain amount of writing on a theme that I call colonial karma, which is the, you know, the 400 years worth of karma that we're continuing to deal with in the West, having to do with the conquest, colonization, and enslavement of the Americas by European cultures. And they talked continuously. They said, we are coming from the Enlightenment era. We're bringing enlightenment to, you know, the West. You know? And so there's all these associations that, you know, in literature and culture, going back 400 years and continuing today, the light of wisdom, the brightness of being able to see, being able to control. And then there's darkest Africa, and there's, you know, there's the darkness that seems to have, darkness is associated with not knowing, it's associated with fear, it's associated with the wild, it's associated with the indigenous, it's associated with all the things that are creepy and awful. But, you know, starting to let go of that, that association of light and dark with good and evil, starting to let go of yin and yang, you know, in Asian philosophy, the two are in balance, you're always in balance, the sun and the moon. And with regard to the Buddhist teachings about awakening, you know, it's not light versus dark. It's surrendering to the interplay and then surrendering to not knowing and then surrendering to knowing all. And that final stage occurs when the fire goes out. Very, very nice contribution. I appreciate that so much. It's good. Okay. Anybody else have anything they'd like to put on the bulletin board, they'd like to share, to cover together? It looks like Jim's hand is up again.
Yeah, I was going to just send a chat note, but I just thought I'd mention it really quickly because I can talk faster than I can type. I've been reading a book that was loaned to me by Ann Hurt, and she has come to our Sangha. Longing for Darkness, Tara and the Black Madonna, China Galland. Really?
Oh, yes.
And see if I can get a picture of it here. Sort of. My telephone. Anyway, it speaks to a lot of the same issues that you were raising, Lloyd.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good. Yeah, China is a wilderness spiritual inquiry leader. I don't know if she's still, I think she may be beyond the age of leading trips herself, but she had this whole realm of practice of taking women into the wilderness. To learn confidence and self-reliance, not, you know, like on outward-bound trips where everything's being led by men, but it was a women's self-empowerment kind of thing. But, yeah, there's a lot of really rich iconography and stuff around the feminine in which, you know, in Asia as elsewhere, is often regarded as the sketchy part, you know, non trustworthy part, you know, the part that you need to be a little suspicious of, but of their power, but as being sort of the hidden spirituality, the stuff that wasn't being acknowledged, you know, from the time that those rituals that Joan Van Beesler and I would do back in the early days over at the Unitarian Church, we would do little snippets of texts like this quote I got from Carl Jung, that one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. The latter procedure, however, is disagreeable and therefore not popular. I kind of like that one. there is also a quote from the Tibetan, the Egyptian Book of the Dead. It says, "We now return our souls to the Creator as we stand on the edge of eternal darkness. Let our chant fill the void in order that others may know. In the land of the night, the ship of the sun is drawn by the grateful dead." So, Carol, please.
I was reminded, Andrea's comment reminded me of that old Yule log tradition, which in pre-Christian times, I guess, I think it's Celtic, where the Yule log, they would actually take a log and dress the log up as if it's a human being, have dinner with it, you know, have a drink, have a few cups of wine, and then they burn it. And the whole idea is it's kind of almost a vestigial human sacrifice, but the idea that you have to have from death comes the light. The light returns to the world, but it comes from a dark place. It comes from death. And I thought that's an interesting metaphor for the seasonal changes of from death comes life, from darkness comes light, you know. But I just was reminded of that old pagan tradition.
Oh, yeah. And Yule, the Norwegian word is jewel. That means circle. So wreaths, those are all emblematic of the cycle of the seasons. So basically it's a Celtic thing rather than, you know, a Christian thing. Interesting. Thank you. Appreciate that. The phrase from the Egyptian Book of the Dead that I just read is often back in, you know, the 60s folklore of music of the time is often cited as the place where the rock group the Grateful Dead got their name from. And so I really tried to track down that, you know, whether there was anything to that or not. Just people I know who lived in the Bay Area at the time and were connected with the folk scene, as well as written accounts I could find. And what I came across instead is a pretty interesting story. Jerry Garcia and a couple of other folks that were founding members of the Grateful Dead, they lived down on the peninsula, San Francisco Peninsula in Palo Alto, and they were like really good natural musicians. They hung out at a couple of different music stores there, places that sold musical instruments, and they just play and jam, and they were so good that they were offering good, you know, guitar lessons to people that would come in and were getting ready to come together to form one group or another. And he was with one of the people who was a very close friend, who was also an extremely gifted musician, around the time that they were putting together their first couple of groups. And they were involved in a horrible traffic accident, high-speed traffic accident. And his best friend was killed in that accident. And and he was very badly injured and eventually recovered completely. And someone asked him how that experience was. And, you know, having lost such a close friend, and he had said, "Well, you know, part of me died as well." Yeah. And the part of me that died, along with the part of me that's still here, are both grateful. So it's like he felt like he was in some way born again, you know, that he had come to an understanding and an appreciation of life that he hadn't had before. That for which he was extremely grateful. and that the part of him that died was grateful too. Yeah, so this whole cycle of death and rebirth is very much woven into the situation. Yeah. And for those of us who may be recovering Christians, there's I was when I was writing the book Worship in the Wilderness, I reading, there's this really interesting text called the Five Gospels, and it's biblical archaeologists who went back and were looking at the studying the authenticity of the texts that went into the crafting of the New Testament, where the different chapters came from and whatnot. And they came to the conclusion that the writings of Thomas, St. Thomas, were just as well grounded in biblical history and his relationship with Jesus of Nazareth as any of the others, and that the reason that his writings didn't make it into the New Testament was primarily political, and it had to do with when the Emperor Constantine, just like the Emperor Ashoka 300 years after the life of the Buddha, he said, well, okay, well, you know, I'm going to make Christianity the religion of the empire, but what's Christianity? He said, I want you people to get together and decide what the canon's going to be, what you agree the teachings of Jesus to have been that we ought to be abiding by. And so when they did that, there were certain texts that the council liked, especially the ones that seemed to reinforce the idea of a relatively authoritarian religious structure. So in other words, that would comport easily with an empire having a state religion, and that the source of authority in the church and that of the empire would be more or less one and the same. And Thomas didn't fit into that at all, because he was quite a mystic, and his writings didn't, and like people like, John and whatnot, didn't really fit into that in the least, and so he got left out. But some of his writings and this book, this text, the Five Gospels that I read, and as well as Elaine Pagel's writings about Thomas, were quite revelatory. And in his writings, when he was advising his followers on how to explain Christianity to those who didn't know it, he taught them, he said, when people ask where you came from, tell them we came from the light. And when they ask who you are, tell them we are children of the light. Yeah. And some of the foundational texts of Unitarianism, Universalism, same thing. It's like there's this inner source of spiritual wisdom that is our guide. It's not an external authority figure. That's what the Buddha taught. It's the wisdom that we need in order to self-liberate lies within, doesn't come from elsewhere. So anyway, here we are, getting ready to go forth, and so a bright new day, right? Thanks everybody for coming around and sitting in. If you could bear with me just a bit longer, there are a couple of songs that I'd like to do that we used to do in the old days, and that maybe we'll do again next year. And this one is uh, one that was put together for the celebration of light service that Joan Van Beesler and I used to do, and that we also do at our Thanksgiving Day of Mindfulness. And it's a riff off of the old spiritual, you know, which in itself is based on the Buddha's words. The teachings of Jesus of Nazareth in the Sermon on the Mount. And, you know, when the Buddha's dying on the Parinibbana Sutta, you know, when his followers were mourning his demise, the fact he was leaving his body, they said, where will we turn when you are no longer here, when you are no longer our teacher? And his response was, be lamps unto yourselves. You know, that which you need to experience freedom, that which you need to experience ultimate liberation, is already within you. Doesn't reside in me, it resides within you. And it's that light that's gonna lead you home. Okay, so and in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, you know, be lamps into the earth, you know, let your light so shine that others will know what is your source of freedom. Okay. So what we did was expand on that original hymnal, that original spiritual, to include a verse having to do with Hanukkah, another having to do with paganism, and then the last one having to do with Buddha Dharma, and you'll probably be able to figure out which they are. And so, yeah, might remember some of those words, but anyway, we'll do the traditional verses in between anyway. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Please sing. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Hide it under a bushel, no, I'm gonna let it shine. Hide it under a bushel, no, I'm gonna let it shine. Hide it under a bushel, no, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. In the temple through the night, I'm gonna let it shine. One night of early nights of light, gonna let it shine. The lamp of hope and faith burn bright, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. And be a lamp unto the earth, I'm gonna let it shine. Celebrate the sun's rebirth, gonna let it shine. Light to heal this wounded earth, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine. A lamp unto ourselves will be, I'm gonna let it shine. Light of wisdom rise to me, gonna let it shine. Light the path that sets us free, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. And this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
All right. Bravo. And Pete Seeger was asked one time, you know, what his definition of folk music was, and he said,
Well, what I learned from my 1 year at Harvard before I dropped out at the end of my freshman year was that if you steal from one person, it's plagiarism. If you steal from 10, it's scholarship. And if you steal from 100, it's original research. And so then there was this question of whether the song that he wrote was folk music or not. And he said, well, said the lyrics are about 3,000 years old and music is about 10 years old. So maybe if you average the two, you got a folk song. So, do everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. Time to be born, a time to die. Time to plant, a time to reap. Time to kill, a time to heal. Time to laugh, time to leave. Permission to sing. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. Time to build up, time to break down, time to dance, time to mourn, time to cast away stones, time to gather stones together. To everything, turn, turn, turn. Is the season, turn, turn, turn. And the time. Every purpose under heaven. Time of love, time of hate, time of war, time of peace. Time when you may embrace, time to refrain from embracing. To everything, turn, turn, turn. Is the season, turn, turn, turn. And the time, every purpose under heaven. Time to gain, time to lose, time to win, time to win. Time of love, time of hate, time of peace. Swear it's not too late. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And the time, every purpose under heaven. And the time, every purpose under heaven.
Amen.
Happy solstice, everybody. See you next year.
Thanks, Carol
thank
Lloyd.
Thank you. That was
hey, Carol Lloyd, somebody wants you to put the book title in chat. Put the
yes.
Book.
Here I am getting thank ready you. To do that even as we speak.
Okay.
Be right back. I got to go get my iPads.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Happy holidays.
Merry
Christmas, everyone.
Bye.
The sky is clear there.
You're muted.
We've had some lovely, clear, sunny days, but today it's cloudy. But the shower goes on, doesn't it? The meteor shower goes on for a couple weeks, maybe?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know. I truly don't know. So you have to Google it.
Yeah. We'll keep watching.
yeah. I know it's good for a couple of days. The paper just said 92 is the peak or something tonight. So
good.
There's a lot of things going on astrologically that are pretty awesome. Saturn and Jupiter are both in air signs. It's been called the dawning of the age of Aquarius, and amazing innovations will start happening. Doesn't mean all the bad stuff is going to go away all at once or anything.
It sounds like a hopeful message.
Yeah, too much hope there, huh?
Hey, Tara Lloyd.
Balance, doesn't it? Hope and despair.
Hey, Tara Lloyd, what would you like to call your talk?
Oh, this is just, this is just a time for us to hang together. I don't think it needs to be preserved for posterity unless you think it should. we could just call it Solstice 2020.
Okay.
So we share, Lloyd, is that a book that you put up or?
No, that is a book.
Okay.
It's just been recently published, The Inner Work of Racial Justice, by Rhonda McGee, and if you go to the website for Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, they were the hosts of it was essentially an interview of Rhonda McGee by Bhante Anilayo. At Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. And it was a fascinating dialogue because she was talking about pretty contemporary stuff around race and caste and whatnot. And then all of a sudden he would come up with a few words about, his scholarship on early Buddhism. And he would go straight to places where he would talk about the Buddha calling out caste in his time, and the evils of caste and the suffering that it caused, he was basically talking about racism in his time, and it was quite powerful, and the monastic sangha in the time of the Buddha, and it was a time when there was real there were powerful forces at work in Indian society. It was the ascendancy of the Brahmins, the ones who were claiming to be the keepers of all religious and spiritual development, and they were claiming to be the pinnacle of the philosopher kings who ought to be governing society. And the next caste, the Kshatriyas, of which the Buddha was actually a member, these were the heads of state, the monarchs and others, and they thought the Brahmins were kind of full of themselves, and so there is all this kind of stuff going on politically. But the Buddha was speaking out not on behalf of his own caste, not on behalf of the Kshatriyas, but when all of this was happening, what he did when he was establishing his monastic sangha, and just as in today's times, people portray their cast membership in terms of their clothing and their adornments and the cars they drive and how they do themselves up, you know, one way or the other. All the symbols of their rank and wealth in society. He said, anyone that's going to sign on with my crew, shave your head, get rid of all your jewelry, and you're going to wear the same robes as everybody else. And the robes that they fashioned for themselves were clothes that people had thrown away, or that were clothes that people had donated to the Sangha. You know, it's like going to the Goodwill store, right? And so they took all these worn out clothes and trimmed off the, you know, the parts that were no longer useful, and they sewed them back together again, and they took them down to riverbanks, and they dyed them in the colors of the mud that were on the riverbanks. And the colors, the dyes in the mud of the riverbanks were basically either a kind of an ochre or sort of a burnt orange color. And so those became sort of the colors of their robes. And that, from that time to this, it's the same thing. Anyone that enters a monastic sangha, you know, they shave their heads and they cast away all adornments and all forms of any symbol of social rank. And so he led a caste-free sangha, where the Brahmins were no higher or lower than the untouchables, the Dalits, who no other spiritual movement would allow in, and they were allowed. And eventually, after being kind of guilt-tripped by his stepmom, he allowed women in. It was the same thing. You know, it's like everyone's the same here, except that they did rank men above women in the early Sangha. But other than that, it was a deliberately caste-free, anti-racist spiritual community. And so, yeah, he was quite the social activist, actually.
Go ahead. Is that, what website did you say that talk may be on?
Berry Center for Buddhist Studies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. What were you saying, Abby? Oh, okay. It's not for sure that it's... I think it's posted on BCBS. I don't know the extent to which it was. At any rate, they are doing a retreat together coming up in the next few months, I think. And so if you just check the BCBS site from time to time, as soon as the retreat's posted, then you can sign up for it if you want.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Tara Lloyd, can you tell me about what the book was, The Five Gospels about Thomas? I'd like to kind of follow up with that a little bit. Is it called The Five Gospels?
Yes. If you just set your browser to search for the title, The Five Gospels, it'll show up. And it has the texts of the Gospels, and it has their provenance. You know, the research that went into verifying the fact that Thomas's writings and his teachings were every bit as authentic as the ones that didn't make it past the Council of Nicaea.
Very, very interesting. I'm on
fascinating stuff. Yeah. Okay.
Very good. Okay, I appreciate your songs. Thank you.
Okay, good.
Very, very cute.
Glad you enjoyed it.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you, everyone. Happy
good night, everybody, and thank you, Kathleen, for hosting.
Sure. Here we go.